Okay, yeah, thanks for allowing me to talk about my work. So basically, I'm going to build on what Francesca talked about yesterday. So I'm actually going to talk about experiments that aren't, I mean, well, possible experiments in polarized Fermi gases that aren't quite there yet, but are probably going to be there in the very near future. So just to remind you of the basic phase diagram that Francesca presented to you yesterday. So here I've here's the spin polarized equal masses case where I'm considering zero temperature. And if you recall, essentially I can describe this phase diagram in terms of two parameters. One which is the some sort of effective interaction, which is given by the dimensionless parameter 1 divided by KFA, where A is the scattering length. And I can use this to tune the system into the BCS limit, where I have very weakly bound pairs, and all the way over to the BEC limit, where I have tightly bound molecules. So basically, this line here corresponds to the BCS to BEC crossover. And then the other parameter I can tune, namely on this axis, is a relative polarization, so given by the difference in spin densities divided by the total density. So here, basically, on this line, I have a fully polarized Fermi gas. So then, basically, what you find is that this phase diagram consists of essentially three types of phases. One which is the normal state undergoing a first-order transition to the superfluid state, and hence giving rise to this phase-separated region here. But as you pass over, if you go far enough into the BEC regime, you encounter this tricritical point here at m equals 1. And so from this point onwards, you have in fact a second-order phase transition from the superfluid to the fully polarized normal state. And actually, this superfluid, as I've denoted SFM here, is just the homogeneous magnetized superfluid, which I'm going to talk about in more detail soon. So now, one obvious there's a couple of number of obvious questions you can ask now. Suppose now if I take the case where the masses are unequal. One question is, okay, so what will happen to this tricritical point? Or am I likely to find any more phases in this diagram than I already have here?
Quick question.
Yeah, sure.
If I move along the horizontal line where and down is equal to zero, there's only majority fermion. Over there. Then I'll go to the tricritical point. But will I notice it? Something will happen.
Or if you just have no spin down fermions?
Mm-hmm.
No, I wouldn't have thought so.
So how should I think of it? Because it's supposed to this right there.
Well, yeah, I mean it's kind of, I mean if you like, it's probably easy to look at it in chemical potential space, because in that case this line corresponds to a whole region. So then you can think of, if you think of it, this point is like you encountered it as soon as you added one like tiny. Density of spin up or spin down, sorry. Yeah.
Sure.
It depends on where you actually sit in this region. So for example, over here I phase separate between just an unmagnetized superfluid and a partially polarized.
When you do the partition, when you say phase separate, you only look at a few candidates.
That's true. Yeah. Yes, I've ignored. That's true. Yeah. So this diagram just takes into account of homogeneous type phases. That's true. Yeah. But I'm gonna. Yeah. I'll talk about FFLO in a moment. But yes, I've neglected FFLO or deformed Fermi surfaces and other more exotic states here. Yeah. Okay. So, okay, right. Whoops. Oh, yeah, okay, fine. So basically, in the first part of my talk, I'm going to address a few issues associated with the unequal mass case. So unequal masses actually isn't a completely abstract or irrelevant question in that it will manifest itself in other systems such as the electron hole bilayers that Francesca mentioned yesterday, or in neutron stars, where generally basically the masses of the two components are unequal, as Vincent mentioned before. So firstly, I'm going to just say a few words about how unequal masses will affect the standard BCS to BC crossover. And then, like I mentioned before, I'm going to ask, you know, what actually happens to the topology of this phase diagram, namely what actually happens to that tricritical point. And further, I'm going to consider, you know, is it possible to have different types of magnetized superfluids, namely, so if I go back to my this diagram, this phase here, is it possible to have different types of breach pair states, namely where the Fermi surfaces are different? So I'll say a few words about that later. And finally, I'm going to consider the case where I take this unequal mass system, put it in a trap at finite temperature, because it turns out that this system has quite a different phase structure in a trap. So one other issue I'll be considering in the second half of my talk is namely what people were asking me about before, which is, okay, what about the FFLA state? So in this diagram here, I haven't shown it here, it actually only occupies a very small region of phase space, as was first pointed out by Dan Sheehy and Lee Radzihovsky. So the question is, can you actually expand that region and see it experimentally? So one possibility is to actually consider a quasi one-dimensional system where I take a two-dimensional optical lattice of tubes, essentially. So that's what I'll talk about in my second part. Okay, so to begin with, the model I'm going to be considering for unequal masses is essentially quite similar to the equal mass case. So I have I assign two different chemical potentials, so spin up and spin down, where I have the Zeeman term H, and I have some effective S wave contact interaction here. So the main difference being, of course, that now I allow my mass to have a spin dependence, and I define a mass ratio R, which is just given by M up divided by M down. So the point to note is that for the rest of my talk, I will be assuming that the number of spin-up fermions is greater than the number of spin-down. So what this means is that if I have R greater than 1, my majority species is heavier, and likewise, if R is less than 1, my majority species is lighter. I mean, I will keep reminding you of this point, so it's easy to forget. Okay, so and then I'm just going to employ a mean field approach. So the idea is just to minimize the mean field free energy. Now, I should point out at this point, there are a number of other works that have considered this same model, but considered different aspects of the problem.
Actually, I think we are the first to talk about unequal masses.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, I will mention you before.
History,
sure. No. Yeah. I will. Yeah. Sorry. I will mention you later. I was just thinking of this particular model. Yeah.
So this non-equal masses, yep. It's generally non-equal dispersion, right? So
yes.
Like pairing between different bands.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So actually, one interesting point is that so in the case of equal masses, if I set H equals 0, that would just correspond to equal numbers. But that's not necessarily the case. I mean, that's not the case in unequal masses, obviously, clearly. So. Okay, so all right. So just to turn quickly to the case where I have a zero polarization, and I look at the BCS to BC crossover. So here I'm just showing you the case where R equals 1. So I have equal masses. So up the top I've just plotted the momentum distribution as a function of k divided by kf. And so here's my usual BCS wave function over here that describes the whole crossover. And so basically you see on the BCS side a step-like distribution function that smoothly evolves to a molecular pair wave function on the BEC side as a function of scattering length. And so basically, I mean, what you find at least at a mean field level is just the same for unequal masses. You just replace the mass by the reduced mass because you're just basically just considering pairs. However, now if I look at the excitation spectrum, so here I've just presented it for equal masses, that the story is slightly different. So, okay, so basically let's focus on that now. Okay, so in the case of equal masses, I have a dispersion relation where the gap occurs at non-zero momenta, if I have a positive chemical potential. But then as I cross over, so this is on the BCS side, but then as I cross over to the BEC limit, the chemical potential goes negative, and eventually I have a minimum that occurs at zero momenta over here. So what's interesting is that in the case of unequal masses, the behavior is somewhat similar, except that now I find, firstly, the two branches with excitations are not identical, I mean, unlike the case of equal masses. And what's more, I find that now for a region around mu equals zero, there's a situation where actually one of the branches, I mean, so in this region here, one of the branches only one of the branches has a minimum at non-zero k. So I mean, and that's actually quite straightforward to see. Here I have my my schematic diagram here of my two dispersions for different masses, and you can see how you get the case where you have one band having minima at finite k, and the other which just is flattened here and has a minima at zero k. Okay, so that's basically the point I want to make about BCS to BEC crossover. Okay, so now let's switch to the point where I have I allow the gas to be polarized, spin polarized, and let's look at the case where I have zero temperature. So here now I've plotted on the left two different zero temperature phase diagrams for different mass ratios. So this case, this R, if you remember that this case corresponds to when the majority species is lighter, and this is where the majority species is heavier, this top part here. So what's interesting to note is actually if you look at this, if you now fix your eye on the tricritical point, what you find is it always exists. Well, at least it always exists in this system. However, it's dramatically shifted as you change the mass ratio. So now if you look at this plot here, so I've got the plots of the tricritical point. So here's one on KFA of the tricritical point as a function of R. So what you find is that, okay, so whoops. So if I take R to zeros, the tricritical point shifts off to basically to plus infinity. And the net result is this region of phase separation expands. And likewise, if I take R to infinity, this tricritical point shifts off to negative infinity. And I basically end up with this region of magnetized, homogeneous magnetized superfluid taking over the whole phase diagram. Actually, at some level, this behavior is at some level, can be understood intuitively. If you think about, you know, essentially what you're doing when you increase the mass is flattening the dispersion of the particle. So therefore, you're making it easier. I mean, you essentially means that if you make the density of these particles larger, you pay less energy to do so. So the net result, at least in this case, so this is where the majority species is heavier. It costs them no energy to basically phase separate into a high density phase. This is what this diagram is essentially showing you.
This is very analogous to the argument that Vincent and
That's right. Yes, it's analogous, except now you're allowing, I guess, phase separation in real space. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so I guess as it turns out, in this case, phase separation takes over the, I mean, as you know, phase separation takes over this, the state that Vincent proposed. Okay, so now that actually, that leads me to my next question is,
can I ask a question? So all of these calculations are done presumably in the case of white resonance, because you had four terms.
Yes, that's right.
But so have you tried to calculate this in the narrow case, or you calculate it only in the wide case?
No, I've only done it in the...
reason I'm asking is because in the wide case, well, these calculations are at most qualitative, and in particular the spectrum, the Spigalugov spectrum which you wrote,
mm-hmm.
explicitly shown, for example, to be incorrect on the BEC side.
Mm-hmm.
So there's always a question of how reliable these calculations are, well, especially in the center of the diagram, at the corners. But one thing which occurred to me is that if you're saying that as R gets decreased, the point of phase separation gets shifted to the right, but then presumably when you're in the far right, you can actually calculate things if assuming that KFA is your plot
here
is going to be it's going to be small.
Oh, you mean yes, KFA, yes, yeah. That's right, yeah.
So maybe it's actually calculable.
I see.
I'm curious if it is. Maybe there's something which shifts the applicability of that expansion to the right at the same time as the separation region gets shifted to the right.
I see what you're saying. So you think perhaps it's possible this whole... Yeah, I see what you mean. So the approximation might break down as you shift further, or you mean it actually you have more applicability? Yeah, okay. I see. That's interesting. Yes.
So that's a very good point, actually. Mm-hmm. I would speculate that if you turn the layer resonance, because you have this I equal mass plus the effective interaction between two fermions will be long ranges.
Mm-hmm.
It's very likely you can have at least two fermion surface bridge pair in states in this phase time. I mean, I'm speculating, I have no calculation, but it's possible.
I think, yeah, I mean.
But in this case, you'll find unstable will be stable, but in other case, you'll find it's possible mm-hmm. stable. Depends on the range.
I see.
Possible.
I mean, my suspicion is that it probably won't, given that, like, when I look at the equations for the narrow Feshbach resonance, essentially you can see that, I mean, you can get the same, I mean, it looks like you basically get the same transition lines, you just quantitatively shift them around, that's the point. I mean, maybe beyond mean field, perhaps, but, yeah, certainly the mean field level, it looks qualitatively similar. Yeah, yeah. So, I mean,
One channel mean field.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's possible. Yeah. All right, so.
Victor, are you saying that it could be so qualitatively wrong even in the BEC regime that it shifts it the other direction of the function of R? It actually makes it grow, or what do you think that could happen?
Well, I don't really know. It has to be checked. Typically, at least in the far BC, all you discover when you do careful calculation that some numbers gets replaced by some other numbers.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I've seen examples, I guess, during this workshop where you might even get wrong results if you trust too much in BC theory. For example, the only example I know is that the spectrum, the Bogdanov-Legendre spectrum, which involves square roots in the far mm-hmm. BC, is completely wrong. But what is correct is mm-hmm. its expansion in powers of delta up to one term in powers of delta and with changes of the numerical coefficient, which you get when you do this expansion replacing by the numerical coefficient. So if your calculation only relies on that expansion, then you're fine. But if you rely on the entire structure or the square root somehow, then you might be making a qualitative error.
Right,
I don't
see.
Know what happens in this example.
Okay, yeah, okay, that's interesting.
See, well, if the particle is heavy,
yes.
a lot of infrared divergences in the diagram.
I see.
Well, you don't take care of the infrared divergences for heavy particles in the heavy liquid.
Mm-hmm.
You have infrared divergences in a parametrically broad region below your heavy liquid.
Right, I see. So you said, I see. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. All right, so now I'd like to just focus on this homogeneous superfluid. So I guess, so the question is, can you get different types? So the idea is, you know, as Vincent pointed out, so you could possibly have, so this is my momentum distribution, and the idea is you could have a breach pair state where you have two Fermi surfaces, So you have the excess fermions sitting at finite k, versus the case where you have just one Fermi surface where you just have the excess fermions sitting at zero momenta and then the pairing tail occurring at finite momenta. So this case I'm described here is just the one that exists in the BC limit of the equal mass phase diagram. And so far, this case is found to be unstable, at least for equal masses. So I guess the question is, in the unequal mass case, is this state ever stable? For the whole range of interactions. So coming back here again. So firstly, to have the BPT state with two Fermi surfaces, you require the chemical potential to be.
Excuse me, could you remind me what is the which peer pair?
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
So what was the mechanism?
This.
This.
Remind you what the breach. It's essentially okay. So you have a superfluid that's homogeneous in real space, but essentially phase separated in momentum space. So the idea is okay. So you have this minority component. It's pairing. Has pairing here, but then it drops to zero dramatically at this point, where the majority spins form a Fermi surface. Form a Fermi C just here.
Both there's Fermi surface inside. Outside.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. That's right. So, okay. One thing to note is that if you only have the two Fermi surfaces, you first require the chemical potential to be greater than zero. Because as soon as it's negative, you automatically lose your. You only have one Fermi surface. You automatically lose your other one. Okay, so that's one requirement. What you find is that actually that occurs in this region here. If you perhaps don't remember that in the BCS to BC crossover. The chemical potential switches sign just around 0.5 here. So basically this region, this SFM state has a positive chemical potential. So we thought, okay, let's look here. So consider basically the case where you have large mass ratios. So this phase expands and you can have a positive chemical potential. However, what we always found is that we only ever got... Oh, sorry, that should be BP1. Typo, I was doing this last night. Okay, sorry, that should be BP1. We only ever find the state where you have one Fermi surface here. And the reason actually is quite, at least I can offer a fairly hand-wavy reason as to why this is the case. The idea is, okay, so if you have a minority band, which has essentially, like, if you... a flat dispersion, so you take the mass to be very large, then the idea is that this species doesn't care where it sits in momentum space, so it's just happy to follow the Fermi surface of this majority species. So in other words, it'll just shift itself to sit here. There's no energy cost to do so. And so the net result is you just have this BP1 state. Sorry, yeah, that's kind of a rather major typo. Yeah, sorry, that should be BP1. Yep. Okay. Okay, so the answer then is no. But what we find is that this BP1 state can have different types of quasi-particle spectra and hence different densities of states. So, for example... So if I take the mass to be small, the mass ratio to be small, okay. So here I have my quasi-particle dispersion here on the left. What you find is the minimum always occurs at zero momenta, and so this is the case where I have a negative chemical potential. However, now if I take the mass ratio to be larger than one, now you see that actually. Despite, even though you only have a BP1 state, so one dispersion has a minimum at at zero momenta. The other band, the quasi-particle spectra, actually can have two minima, so minima at finite Q. So this effect can show up quite dramatically in the density of states where you have basically get a singularity at this point here. Okay. So, So, and there's actually one other way of...
What was the point of the previous
two? So the point was that actually, even though you could only get BP1, you could actually get two types that you can distinguish between two types of BP1, that's all. Yeah, because actually, this is the kind of dispersion you'd expect for a BP2 state, for example, this quasi-particle dispersion. So if you like, another Fermi surface can show up in your density of states. Okay, so and then the other way of distinguishing between BP1 is say looking at pair correlations, which for example, so this is I have a density correlator up here, which you can measure say using noise correlations. So here, okay, so once again I have my two different mass ratios, one for small r, one for large. So both in momentum, if you look at the momentum distribution, they both have this BP1 structure. However, if you look at the pair correlations, in one case, okay, so you just have this smooth decay of the pair correlation. But in the other one, actually, you end up with a peak just outside at the positive chemical potential. My point is that the BP1 state can have different structure when you look at say the quasi-particle spectrum, or if you look at the pair correlation. So this, if you like, is like some sort of a pairing at finite momentum once again. Okay, so that's kind of the point. Does that make sense?
Actually, I didn't know the force
dimension.
So
it's a maximum.
I know this one.
Yeah, so it's like... Why it goes up? Because essentially, like I was saying, it's all related to having a positive chemical potential. So, if you write down this expression, you find it appears in the denominator. So you end up with a peak. All right, so how am I going for time? Half an hour. Okay, great. So now let's switch gears a bit and look at the trapped Fermi gas case. So here, just to remind you, what's traditionally used is what's called the local density approximation, where you absorb the trapping potential into the chemical potentials. And then the net result is in a trap, the difference in chemical potential stays constant. So H, this Zeeman term, is constant. But this average nu, of course, varies. So basically the net result is this H divided by nu varies across the trap. So this was actually first considered by Duan's group. So if you remember what I said before, H equaling zero in the case of unequal masses does not correspond to equal numbers. So it's kind of this feature that's going to actually show up now and give you different structure in the trapped case. So let's show you what I mean. So here I've got my trap, my finite temperature phase diagram in a trap. So I'm taking the unitarity limit, so the 1 on KFA equals 0. And here, okay, so here's my equal mass case. So I've plotted T as a function of H. And essentially the trajectories in a trap correspond to these lines here. So if I go along these lines and like so, it corresponds to going from the center to the edge of the trap. So basically you can see that if I have a if I have a low temperature, then I have superfluid in the middle. Okay, so I have All right, so I have superfluid in the center of core, and then I undergo a first order phase transition to the normal state on the outside. And likewise, when I increase temperature, I end up with this the same structure, but now I have a continuous transition from the superfluid to the normal state. Okay, so now if I decrease the mass ratio, so what you can see is the effect is to actually shift this whole dome structure to the left. So when I decrease the mass.
Excuse me, may I ask you about the numbers? Like, it looks like T over mu is superfluid below 0.6. Strange normalization.
T over mu? Yes.
T over mu.
Yes.
But there's no superfluid above 0.2.
This is not the same. Mu, yeah. Mu is different from.
Not EF.
Because it's, yeah, mu is smaller. Mu is about, let's see if I can remember now, 0.6 EF. Yeah.
So the solid line means, the black solid line means what?
This is second order.
Second order.
Yes. Okay. And this is first order. Uh-huh. This dotted line is just like what it would have been if it was second, is just the spinodal line.
So line would expect some phase separation.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
The homogeneous phase line, the other one?
Yes. What about the homogeneous one?
No, in the plane of polarization.
He's asking, without that, this is like a temporal potential. Phase
mm-hmm. Yes.
So he's asking you, phase diagonal, for this point corresponding to the polarization.
So when you close it.
Yeah, so if you like, okay, so that was for 0T, so if I sit here.
You close to the phase.
Yeah, diagonal. So this corresponds to that. This corresponds to the whole phase. Yeah.
And the dashed line, so what would be the second order, what does that mean?
Oh, it's like a line, a spinodal line, so it tells you if you like. It would
locally, so if you just look at the so locally unstable.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Exactly. Yeah, so there's no local minima, basically.
So this tri-cooling component is at finite temperature, right?
Right, yes.
It's smoothly connected to. We showed another tri-critical point at zero temperature.
That's right, yes. Yeah, that's what. Yes, that was. Yeah.
At finite temperature, expanding to this one?
Yes, that's smoothly connected as a vary interaction. Yes, that's right. That's what Francesca mentioned, in her talk yesterday. So now when I decrease the mass ratio, I end up actually just. The effect is to shift this whole dome. To the left in this case. So here in this case, I just end up with the same similar structure as before if I follow these two trajectories. Now the situation gets a little bit different if I dramatically increase the mass ratio. Actually, sorry, I should point out that here I've just shown a very large mass ratio, but if I had kept on decreasing it, this would have kept going that way as well. The 3/2, spin up, yeah, that's right. All right, so now actually if I shift it far enough, it's actually so far shifted, it goes beyond H equals zero. So now you can start to get very interesting phases in the trap. So for example, if I follow this line here, I can start with the normal at the center, superfluid in the middle, and then normal again on the outside. So if you like, I end up with this superfluid shell. And what's more, depending on how I change my temperature, I can change, say, the transitions to the superfluid to normal state. So, for example, if I take this trajectory here, I have two first order transitions. So I have two discontinuous sort of points in my trap when I go into the superfluid. Unlike this case, where here I have a continuous transition.
But you can also do the same starting from
here. But you have to start from. theory.
I mean, the difference of the contains.
That's right, yes,
because
yes.
The mass ratio is not a 1, it's not a.
So you mean, why can't I start
yeah.
here, you mean, or?
Yeah, I mean,
because you see. But you see, if the point is t divided by h is constant in the trap. So I always have to start from zero, if you like. So they have the same dependence, because I have h divided by mu. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. So, yes, I always.
I mean, the point I want to make is h plus the mean, because the symmetry between half and down is already put by hands only.
That's true, yeah, sure, absolutely. So this.
Much less mean than the
h. Yeah. That's true, exactly. So it just turns out that the way in a trap, though, because H actually has some more meaning. It, I mean, it ends up you end up with a different structure in the yeah. No, that's true. And okay, and basically, if I push myself far enough, now you notice that this tricritical point here has disappeared. So that corresponds to so if you remember in the zero temperature diagram, how the zero temperature tricritical point shifted. So now this point is the case where I just have only second order transitions in my zero temperature diagram at unitarity. So yeah, so actually in this case you can end up with, you know, basically similar shell structures, but now you can have continuous transitions here.
Can I ask, am I interpreting you right that there's a region there where if you increase the temperature it goes from normal to squeeze loop?
So on the right hand side of that, here, is it here or here? Oh, here. If I increase the temperature here, and I because it's kind of like a right. Yeah. So
under this approximation.
But I suppose it's kind of yeah. I mean, also it's kind of confusing with this what H actually means. That's the thing as well. In chemical potentials, because now.
What happens to the polarization?
It doesn't have anything.
What happens to the polarization as you follow this trajectory?
Yeah.
I think that may be the artifact of this local density approximation.
Well, actually, I think it's also perhaps because I'm plotting in chemical potential. Like, I think if you plot it in density, you won't get this. Yeah. It's just because in the unequal mass case, the chemical potential is like the H. Fixing H doesn't. Had the same meaning as fixing H in the equal mass case. That's the problem. That's the point.
Mm-hmm. What is the
KF? Oh, sorry. Yeah, we're at unitarity. Yeah. Yeah.
So it looks like the topology always saying, is there any possibility that this town actually wake up.
do something really exciting. no, at least.
The bridge there is anywhere.
No, there's
another
different. You look at the second right now, right?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's true. You end up with different trends. you want something even more dramatic. Okay. Yeah, that's.
Cheers.
The subfree here is more like the uniform subfree, including pieces like all the digital and magnetized.
Right.
Homogeneous.
Yeah, right. So you can have,
polarized.
Yeah, so I mean, yeah. So yeah, generally at a finite temperature, it will be polarized, but yeah. That's right. Okay, so is that any more questions? Or?
A slightly different question, but maybe I'm too naive here, but isn't it true that if you do a mean field theory, then you always try to minimize the number of gap excitation, so you always sort of exaggerate the stability of more gap phases? I'm just wondering, you know, you said that in your approximation you exclude this PP2 phase, which has basically more gap excitations. I'm just wondering.
Whether it's possible, the mean field.
It could be a problem with the mean field theory. Mean field theory will certainly prefer, the smaller number of gaps. I don't know, maybe I'm too naive.
Oh, okay.
That was my impression, so.
Possibly, I mean, because I guess, yeah, because I guess, So you're saying, for example, it'll favor the homogeneous, the unmagnetized superfluid over. I mean, it's possible, I guess.
Back to your question, actually, this is related to this sound spectrum. Sound spectrum. There's this effect here, so basically talking about the fluctuation here. So we have this symmetry, like the phase diagram, where they can show there's a GP2 phase.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, of course, they can't tell you how large the window is, but definitely it's possible.
You're saying that
you're talking about fluctuation.
Yes,
they're basically talking about fluctuation and how the system will stay on the fluctuation and how it will stay in the part of the phase diagram.
Yeah.
So according to your yesterday's talk, two channel mean field seems to be working very well.
Right.
For all experimental parameters.
What
do you
mean?
Okay, so you avoid the large coupling parameters.
With fluctuation.
No, theoretically, it's controlled, but experimental systems are not.
Yeah, they're not so. Right.
In the two-channel model regime, so
I always thought that the two-channel is more realistic than the one-channel.
No, two-channel is theoretically very clean and you do all the calculations and
right,
a small parameter, which is the width of the resonance of the Fermi energy. But experiments are in very large, broad resonance limits.
You can make it broad, but
then you may as well just use the
there's another coupling in the two-channel model that allows you to calculate faithfully, quantitatively, but experiments are not nowhere near that regime.
But then your two-channel model can also apply to the wide resonance and the narrow resonance.
Yeah, I mean it's just as bad.
Okay. All right. So the punchline basically is if I make the mass ratio large enough, so if I make it larger than 3.95, as it turns out, you end up with this superfluid shell structure. Alternatively, so this corresponds to making, say, 1 on R less smaller than 1 on 3.95. Because of the symmetry of R. Okay. All right. So to conclude this part, essentially I've just shown you that in the unequal mass case, you find a smooth evolution of the tricritical point in the phase diagram, going from negative infinity to positive infinity. One on KFA going from negative infinity to positive infinity as I vary R. And at least I find in the mean field case and for the S wave interactions that this BPT state is not stable.
You mean the S
wave on site? Yeah. Contact S wave interactions, yes. However, I pointed out that you do actually see differences in the density of states in pair correlations for the BP1 state. It seemed reminiscent of what you would expect for a BP2 state. And finally, in a trapped gases at finite temperature, you can see these superfluid shell structures if the mass ratio is larger than 3.95. This is at unitarity, I should point out. All right, so I don't know how much time I have left. How am I going? Okay. Right, because next I was going to tell you a bit about work I'm doing on polarized Fermi gases in the quasi 1D case. So this is work in progress actually. So now I'm going to leave unequal masses behind, and switch to the case where I have a 2D optical lattice of 1D tubes. All right. So the question is, why bother? Firstly. So apart from the fact that it is actually experimentally realizable. So the other motivation I mentioned before is you can hopefully expand this region of full deferral Larkin-Ovchinnikov phase in the phase diagram. And the reason for that is very straightforward. Okay, so if I take my two Fermi surfaces, spin up and spin down, with Fermi wave vectors separated by Q. Whoops. And here's the same situation in 1D, where I have two lines now, Fermi surfaces represented by points. Then you see quite simply that when I shift one of these surfaces so that I end up with the two Fermi surfaces touching in the case of, say, 2D or 3D, whereas this only corresponds to a small point on the Fermi surface, because I have perfect Fermi surface nesting in 1D, this essentially corresponds to the whole Fermi surface on this side. So what you'd expect basically is for the FFLO to be greatly stabilized in the 1D regime. And another point is actually, there's the, okay, so I mentioned before you can have bizarre phases in the trap for unequal masses. There's also the possibility of phase inversion, if you like, in the trap for the quasi-1D case, namely where you have, say, the normal phase or partially polarized phase on the inside and then surrounded by the superfluid. And you can argue that quite simply by, say if you took the BCS expression for the gap here, where I have the density of states appearing in the exponential, the idea is simply that because in 1D the density of states is given by this 1 over the square root of the Fermi energy, if I take EF smaller, so decrease EF or decrease density, there is the possibility that the gap can actually increase. So basically the idea is that the superfluid can be less dense than the normal state in this case. Okay, so there has actually already been work on the truly one-dimensional case in the gases, so completely non-interacting tubes, so completely isolated tubes. And these two groups have done it using the Beta-Ansatz calculation. So here I've just taken it from the paper of Orsay. So I have plotted chemical potential versus H. And so what you actually do see here is, I have my fully polarized normal, partially polarized state, and then, fully paired superfluid, partially polarized state, and then the fully polarized normal on this side. And you can see now if I sit at this point here and follow this line, which corresponds to, say, a typical trajectory in a trap, see, because I fixed H, you find indeed that you can start from a partially polarized case and move to a fully polarized case on the outside as you go from the center to the edge. I should mention actually that this phase should actually be replaced by FFLO, which is actually what this group showed. So essentially this whole phase here is an FFLO state.
So you say it's an exact solution,
right?
But there are two different exact solutions.
Or rather, it's kind of how they identify the phase, rather. So they get the same phase diagram. It's more like this group, as I said, this is actually the FFLO state. This is can be identified as that.
Just a commensurate transition.
Right. Yeah.
Understood in the sense of algebraic order, right?
Yes, yeah. I think, well...
That's the whole thing. That was the whole point. So this why it was not mentioned in the Oslo paper, because the correlation functions were never calculated explicitly.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
So partially polarized means you could be uniform...
You get these solitons, I think.
Yeah.
Right.
Solitons. So it's really like...
Right.
Just non-linear.
It's just, essentially it's how you identify it.
May I ask you just to understand it? Sure. Well, if you use the same kind of midfield theory which you used for the first part and superimpose on this graph.
Yes, actually, that's a good question. Yeah, I was just about to get there. Actually, yes. So what I find when I do mean field, I don't actually have the graph here, but it sort of qualitatively reproduces this. I mean, okay, obviously it gets this line and this line correct, because this is just the fully polar. I mean, this is just the fully polarized case, this is just the two-body case.
So the shady there is the vacuum.
Pardon? This is the vacuum, yes, sorry, yeah. That's the vacuum area. But and it kind of qualitatively reproduces this, but it completely screws up this point of intersection. So, for example, I mean, basically, I don't get the, all these lines intersecting at one point. They intersect at several points. So this phase is overestimated. So this creeps in more, and then, so basically, it destroys this point. Yeah. And the other thing is, the mean field tends to think these are first order lines, when obviously they're not.
What's the dotted line in the center?
Oh, I think that's just zero.
No.
No, sorry. What am I saying? Sorry. That's okay. So that's 0.5. Corresponding. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I see. Just a blow up.
Yeah. So this is sorry. This is the blow up of this point here.
I'm curious about your remark because on the left hand side is a very special case for one dimension where I decrease mu. In fact, the interaction actually gets stronger. And therefore, it actually paired below. And
yes.
You say that you get that line also.
Yes, like this. That's right. Yeah.
That
you mean going down like this? Yes. Yeah. Because you don't think I should get this slope? You think it should? Okay, maybe we can talk about. Yes.
In this situation, the interactions are assumed to be attractive, just some attractive interactions.
Yes. Oh yes, sorry. This is the binding energy. Actually, I neglected to mention that. Sorry. Yeah.
Binding energy.
Yeah.
The two-body binding energy.
Two-body binding energy. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So this is just some measure of the interaction here.
And so even if H is taken to zero, partially polarized state will survive, meaning that this curve will keep raising up. The curve separating partially polarized and fully paired states.
Yes. So if I take H to zero down here,
the curve will eventually go up.
Yes, it keeps going up. Yes. Yes. So yeah, so this is expanding as I take that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Okay, so the model I'm thinking about is slightly different. I consider the more general case where I add a hopping between the one-dimensional tubes. So the idea being that this can be encompass the more general situation in the experiment, and also it's actually could be beneficial to have some correlation between the tubes, given that if you're trying to measure an FFLO state, you have a better chance of measuring it if the phases in each tube are phase locked, at least in some way. So, okay. So basically, I consider it very much a similar model as before, except now I replace my dispersion essentially a tight binding dispersion. So I assume a single band of hopping in the kx and in the x and y directions, and I have a free dispersion in the z direction. Along the tube, and then also I have this one-dimensional, this effective interaction in the tubes, which is actually derived by Bergman et al. In 2003, and you can relate that actually to the three-dimensional scattering length. So here, this length is just a length associated with the actual trapping of the tube, and this A is just a constant of order one. I have my one-dimensional effective interaction in terms of a three-dimensional scattering length in the tubes, and then actually I can drive a crossover from essentially I can look at the dimensional crossover from 3D to 1D just by varying the density in this model. So you'd expect I recover a 3D limit when I take the chemical potentials to be much less than T. So this is the case where I can just expand this for small kx, so I just have k squared dispersion then, so a three-dimensional dispersion. And likewise, if I can just recover the 1D limit when I take chemical potentials to be much larger than this hopping parameter T. So I'm going to employ a mean field approach, which, well, as was pointed out earlier, I don't expect it to completely get all the details right in 1D, especially in 1D. But at least I'm hoping to capture some, so at least to call it some sort of general aspects of the behavior in this system.
You say the typology of lines is not the same.
Yes, that's at this point, yes. I'm just going to be careful of, but it gets like, say, at least some of the slopes correct. But yeah, you're right. I mean, I'm not going to trust, say, the order of the transition or the exact kind of, yeah, points of intersection. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, it's just like, best thing to start off with as a starting point. Yeah. Okay. And then, so I'm going to actually characterize my model by just three-dimensional parameters. I've chosen it to be H over T, mu over T, and then this hopping written in terms of T as well. Okay, so basically the idea is, you know, as you go towards the one-dimensional limit as these parameters get very large, so as this, for example, as mu over T gets very large. Okay, so let's just start off with a simple case where I take H equals zero, so I have just an unpolarized gas. So here, I've just plotted this effective interaction as a function of mu, and so here I just end up with a line separating the vacuum from the superfluid state, and this line is essentially just the given by the appearance of the energy of the two-body bound state. So where mu f is just half the binding energy. Where mu is just half the binding energy, and because I'm dealing with not a completely one-dimensional system, it's not surprising that I actually require a critical interaction before I get the appearance of a two-body bound state. Okay. So now, when I consider it, consider H over T is equal to 1. So now I consider the same G versus mu diagram. Now I have a lot more structure. So instead of just the vacuum and superfluid state, I first have this fully polarized normal state denoted by P here around the mu equals zero, and then a partially polarized normal state. And here now I've calculated a large region of FFLO state. Well, actually, to be honest, this line I've actually calculated using a single wave vector, so the FF approximation. But the message is clear, is that this region, which used to be such a small sliver in the 3D diagram, is actually opens up into a large region in the quasi 1D system. And so actually, and as I head towards this direction, so head towards the 3D limit, if you like, I recover a tricritical point in this diagram here, right? And a small region of the magnetized superfluid state over here, which didn't exist, if you remember, in the completely 1D diagram. So what you find actually is that now if I take a trajectory in the trap, so that corresponds to, say, going along this line, say from the center to the edge, I can end up with quite a, you know, rich collection of phases. So for example, you see here. Because I have a minimum here and a change of slope, I can actually end up with the partially polarized state on the inside, go through a superfluid, and then end up with the normal state on the outside as I hit 3D limit. So essentially, it's like I'm going from 1D to 3D in the trap as I change the density. So you can get quite a lot of interesting phases in the trap just because of the way you're varying the density. Assuming, of course, the local density approximation holds. Okay, and actually I should mention these curves just go off to infinity like that, which you can argue just by looking at how these depend on hopping or how they should behave in the 1D limit. Okay, right. All right, and just quickly to show you that it's qualitatively similar when I increase H, so this is just this superfluid to normal line here. Essentially, all that happens is this minimum kind of flattens out a bit and shifts to higher mu, as you'd expect. But it's sort of, so essentially as I head towards the more 1D limit, this I get, in my trap, I'll get a larger and larger region of the phase where I have this partially polarized, this FFLO state, if you like, in the center, and the superfluid on the outside. Okay. Sorry, here? Oh, I thought they were going to, okay. So so finally just a quick word about the FFLO phases I've been considering. So far I've just been considering the very simple case to simplify calculations, consider the simple plane wave case, if I look at the dispersions of particles and holes, essentially, it corresponds to opening a gap, like shifting one of these dispersions this way and then opening gaps this way. However, if you want to solve the full problem, consists of a cosine of QR, so a periodic modulation in the gap, you really need to consider, all possible kind of dispersions at different Q values, not just the single Q, as illustrated in this plot. The net result of this case is that now, at least in the 1D case, you end up with a whole series of bands with the Brillouin zone given by this kind of Q, if you like, the size of the Brillouin zone. And so you end up with a gap. So in this case, where you only had a gap opening up at one Fermi surface, you have it's a fully gapped state here. Okay, so I haven't drawn it because it's kind of, I found it was getting quite complicated. But basically you find you have this fully gapped state in the LO state, at least in the 1D case. So now with this in mind, bearing this in mind, what you actually find is in the quasi 1D case, you can have two types of FFLO. One where essentially you're in the 1D limit, so you can have the gap appearing around the whole surface, Fermi surface. And the other, when you start to see curvature to the Fermi surface, then you end up with places on the surface where it's not gapped. So you end up with a gaplet, what you call. So ideally, so you have what's called a commensurate and versus incommensurate state. And you can actually mark these two phases in this diagram here. So this is my h divided by t equals 1 case again. Whether this can actually be measured in experiment is a good question.
So your Q changes when you change mu?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, yeah. I don't have actually, unfortunately, a plot. But essentially, because as mu increases, Q decreases because h divided by mu is getting smaller. The polarization is getting smaller.
Another thing is that if you want to apply this to a trap, then you lose the translation in there. So
Right. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I've only considered very simple calculations for the FFLO, because I know in the trap it's going to depend on, the boundary conditions and, yeah, you're right. So the modulation, the exact details of the modulation will, of course, depend on the trap geometry. Yeah.
So the Q is kind of roughly set by the purpose of the difference. Maybe you can make the
You think it's possibly, or I thought maybe the other, yeah, that's true, yes, that's true. Yeah. So if you want to, if you put in enough oscillations, yeah. 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 That's true, yeah, so you're kind of having to, right, so you kind of playing this balancing game, balancing act. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you explain this incommensurate? What does the increment? Can we compare two periodicities again?
If you like. The point is okay. So in this case, I have bands. Given by with the unit cell given by say. Whoops.
Too close.
or Q, depending on how you define it. So this in the 1D case, you just have a fully gapped system. So you have, you know, but in like a fully occupied sort of lower band. But it, as you, if you go to the 3D case, then, okay, so say if I look, this is KZ, in this direction I have, say, KX. And this, so the Fermi surfaces look something like this, right? So they're not, obviously not completely flat. So the idea is so here, for example, I might have a fully gapped case here. But as I move along this direction, I might end up with the case where I, let's see, so it's going down, so I might have the case where I cross here. So I lose some, so I only have a partially filled band. So I think this is the idea between commensurate and incommensurate. So commensurate is when you have like, fully filled band, you have like roughly two particles per unit cell, whereas in the case where you end up with where you empty part of the band on the surface, you don't have two particles per unit cell. Does that make sense?
So only happens in quasi 1D.
Yes, only happens in quasi 1D. Yeah, so usually I feel like this is the more 3D case, the incommensurate case. So this is like the 1D going to 3D type of law. Yeah. Okay. All right. So just to conclude now. All right. So hopefully I argue that, quasi 1D systems are not a complete waste of time, that you can access a lot of interesting FFLO phases. And what's more, it shows up as quite a rich collection of phases in the trapped gas. And so actually one question I haven't fully answered really is like whether the FFLO modulations in each tube, or when the FFLO modulations of each tube are phase locked, like how much coupling do you need to actually get them to talk to one another. So that's actually important for if you want to actually measure it in experiments. Well, certainly at the moment, I mean, it'd hopefully be quite easy to measure, say, this kind of phase inversion where you have partially polarized with a superfluid on the outside. Okay.
So all right. To measure it means there's no nodes. Usually, flow state has the nodes, right?
Right.
This is incommensurate case.
Yes.
So you get
yes.
the gap to see something at the nodes.
Right, right.
This is commensurate means there's always gap.
Yes, yeah, in the 1D. Yeah, I think, I mean, okay, I didn't draw it. I was. If you sort of go back to this thing, and you try and draw the resulting bands, you find that's what you find, that you can find it's the gaps always appear at this line. Yeah. I mean, I can show you. It was just kind of getting complicated on the graph.
So FF state is commensurate, it always has a gap.
But it also has like a gapless points on the surface as well, like this state. Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Thank you.
Questions?
Yeah.
I have a comment which I want to.
Sure.
Make. So I had a chance during this talk to think about. About the first half of the talk, about what happens when you have a large ratio between those two species of fermions and you're in the wide resonance regime. And I've noticed that it is known that if this ratio is bigger than 13, actually two heavy and one light particle will form three body states with binding
right.
energy, which will be enormous, much bigger than any other energies in the system, and this whole phase diagram will collapse.
Sure, sure.
So at least that phase diagram shouldn't be looked at ratios, either way, are smaller than one or are bigger than one, but that ratio should be between 13 and 1 over 13.
Yeah, that's true.
On the other hand, in a many-body system, maybe it's more stabilized. So.
Well, but you see, sure, but at least the similar thing which can happen that these triplets, they will be Fermi particles and they'll form some kind of Fermi seam, but they'll sit, you know, if there are zero energies here, they'll be down there. So
yeah, sure, well, sure, I can see. Yeah, I can see.
But
it's 3-body
one.
Yeah.
What is also possible that then actually they'll start forming bigger things eventually, not just a piece of soil.
Yeah, that's true. Fortunately, I think lithium and potassium was like 6.7 or something. That's what I was checking. So at least it's kind of in in that below 13 point, whatever, point, yeah, 0.6.
But also it requires equilibration to go to a low energy state. You don't always go to the, you know, if that state is sufficiently far below, then you don't go.
The thing about is a few more states, including the whole hierarchy of that, going from very shallow to very deep.
If they're shallow ones, yes, but if it's just the deep ones, then...
The analogy with boson physics, what happens with bosons, shows that the transition rate into those lower states is going to be extremely high and controlled by scattering length. So the closer you are to unitarity, the faster the decay into the states will go. So at least close to unitarity definitely cannot do anything.
So
it would be like a solid, that's very high density.
Yeah.
In practice, so much energy will be released that the thing will explode.
That's not good. Okay. That's true, but I remember looking at the Shlapnikov and Petrov thing, the mass ratios.
That's
quite
a good case, right? That is very extreme.
Yeah, yeah. Oh yes, that's right. The really the yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in midfield, so the mass is 10 plus 0. I mean, that's all the calculation from to show that there is change in the rest of mass ratio, even if you are only in this body.
I think
M equals 0 is
M equals 0?
No, I'm saying in that case, it shows that the stability changes with the mass ratio.
Everybody leave it because there's not a topic.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
so let's thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.